Hello and welcome to another edition of Alternative Press Review. I'm Randy Goodlungen, and this week I'm reading from The Nation magazine. This is a double issue for October 28th and November 4th. We're going to start with the editorial page titled All the President's Henchmen. This is written by Joan Walsh, that's W-A-L-S-H, for The Nation. After weeks of ever-worsening news about how Donald Trump, according to multiple accounts, held up military aid to Ukraine until the country promised to investigate Joe Biden's fabricated corruption and Trump's nutty conspiracy theories about the origins of the Russia probe, it remains remarkable how this godless New York grifter so thoroughly took over a political party that pretended to be about sober conservatism, Christian piety, and balanced budgets. Let's look at four administration stalwarts up to their necks in this mess: Vice President Mike Pence, Attorney General William Barr, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, and Acting White House Chief of Staff Mick Mulvaney. Together, they represent the four tent poles of the modern GOP circus: the extreme Christian right, the stolid GOP establishment, the corporate Koch brothers wing, and the allegedly anti-deficit, actually white nationalist Tea Party. When those tent poles go down, they could bring the whole sad party with them. Barr is starting to make career racist Jeff Sessions look like Eric Holder. Even Trump critics in the legal community hoped Barr would cure what ailed the Justice Department after Sessions' impaired successor, remember Matt Whitaker, had to leave the stage. Instead, Barr has turned out to be just what Trump asked for, his Roy Cohn. Over the past month, we've learned that Barr traveled to foreign capitals at least once, circumventing local U.S. diplomatic staff to, quote-unquote, investigate the debunked notion that some of America's top allies helped gin up the Russia probe to discredit Trump's presidency. Equally disturbing, Barr ignored the recommendation of the CIA's general counsel to criminally investigate Trump's heavy-handed requests of Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky, even though Trump mentioned Barr on the call, which many believe means the Attorney General should have recused himself. Who knew Sessions had more professional integrity? But Barr's perfidy shouldn't surprise us. Instead, it should remind us that the Ukraine scandal is less like Watergate, which, bad as it was, involved only domestic politics, and more like the Reagan-Bush-Iran-Contra scandal and its aftermath, in which Barr was also implicated as George H.W. Bush's attorney general. While arms for hostages might sound marginally more honorable than arms for political dirt, the attempted trades are comparable: two efforts backed by a GOP White House to subvert the bipartisan foreign policy appropriations of Congress and advance Republican interests. In case you missed the connection, Trump gave Reagan's Attorney General Ed Meese the Presidential Medal of Freedom on October 8th. Barr, who advised Bush to pardon the indicted conspirators of Iran-Contra, is up to his neck in both betrayals of his country. He helps prove that even the pre-Trump Republican Party was more interested in power than rectitude. If Congress is not too busy, Barr should be impeached, as should Pompeo. In 2016, as a Kansas congressman supported by Charles and David Koch, and best known before that for running an aircraft supply company into the ground, Pompeo warned that Trump would be an authoritarian president who ignored our Constitution. Now he's helping Trump do just that. After ducking questions about it, Pompeo had to admit he was on the July 25th call in which Trump pressured Zelensky to investigate Biden in exchange for military aid that Congress had already approved. That was bad enough. Then Pompeo attempted to defy Democratic subpoenas for information about the Ukraine mess, complaining his political opponents were intimidating and bullying State Department officials. Unfortunately for him, some of those officials have agreed to testify before Congress, and House Intelligence Committee Chair Adam Schiff suggested that his committee could include Pompeo's defiance in articles of impeachment involving the administration's habitual obstruction of justice. Shortly thereafter, former Ukraine envoy Kurt Volker shared a raft of once encrypted texts that demonstrate the arms for political dirt quid pro quo that Pompeo and other Trump defenders deny existed. Others who were subpoenaed also indicated their willingness to testify. Pompeo should also be impeached, but Barr comes first. Then there's Mulvaney, the South Carolina Tea Party Republican, was a founding member of the Wingnut Freedom Caucus and purported to be a mortal foe of deficit spending, at least by a black president, as it turns out. Like Pompeo, Mulvaney opposed Trump in 2016, calling him a terrible human being, but then took multiple jobs in his administration. He's still Office of Management and Budget head, as well as acting White House Chief of Staff. First, he peddled the budget-busting Trump tax cuts. Now he's the guy who gave the order to halt congressionally approved military aid to Ukraine, as Trump directed. He has also been subpoenaed to provide a library full of administration documents to the committees investigating impeachment. I don't think you can impeach a White House chief of staff, but Mulvaney will go down in history as a corrupt hypocrite who helped prove that the Tea Party movement was about big racism, not small government. Which brings us to Pence. Mother save us. He could have been the GOP's modern-day Gerald Ford, who, as Richard Nixon's second vice president, stepped in to save the party when its corrupt leader had to resign. But Pence is now in the running to become the 21st century Spiro Agnew. To be fair, we have no evidence of Pence's personal corruption, which is what brought down Nixon's first vice president. But Pence has let himself get so close to Trump that he gives the president impeachment insurance. After news of the Zelensky call broke, Trump first told reporters, "I think you should ask for VP Pence's conversation, because he had a couple of conversations also." Then White House officials leaked that Pence's top national security advisor was on the Zelensky call as well, that the vice president had likely received detailed notes on it, and that he'd been sent by Trump to emphasize the administration's concern about corruption when Pence met Zelensky during his trip to Poland in August. Uncharacteristically, Team Pence pushed back on those claims, but it's probably too late. Trump has set him up so that if congressional Republicans ever begin to walk on 2 feet again, they will know that impeaching Trump could put in the White House the person behind Pence in the line of succession. Can you say President Nancy Pelosi? If I can't honestly say when Trump's poll numbers sink so far underwater that congressional Republicans abandon him and get behind impeachment, Trump will be swiftly swept away. Mainstream media will lionize the defectors and paper over the rot at the center of the party. Then it will be on the rest of us to remind them that this is Trump's GOP. As Pompeo once said about Trump, "It's time to turn down the lights on the circus." That was the editorial page taken from the double issue of The Nation magazine through November 4th. It was written by Joan Walsh. And now, another editorial essay here from the editorial section, titled "Trump Trashes California." This is vengeful, vengeful mob-style politics. On October 4th, the Bureau of Land Management announced that it was ending a five-year moratorium on the selling of oil and gas drilling leases on public lands on California's central coast. The Bureau will soon be seeking bids for drilling on 725,000 acres of land across 11 of California's most beautiful counties. This is just the latest in a series of extraordinary efforts by the Trump administration to slap down California, the front line of states' resistance to Trump, and to use federal powers to dilute the state's environmental protections, arguably its proudest political achievement of recent decades. Donald Trump has been stewing about the Golden State ever since it voted overwhelmingly for Hillary Clinton in 2016, helping ensure that he lost the popular vote nationwide by more than 3 million votes. And he has sought payback against its political representatives and its population centers ever since the leader of the state Senate and the Speaker of the State Assembly issued an extraordinary joint announcement the day after the election condemning Trumpism. As the Los Angeles Times recently documented, Trump has, on a near daily basis, tweeted insults about the state's politics, its culture, its politicians, even its misfortune with forest fires. Early in his presidency, Trump and his congressional allies fashioned a tax reform that went out of its way to financially penalize middle-class Californians by limiting the extent to which property and state taxes could be deducted on federal tax returns. The result was that while most Americans, especially those in red states, saw some short-term financial benefits, skewed heavily toward the well-off, home-owning Californians in expensive parts of the state saw their federal tax burden significantly increase. The state's Franchise Tax Board has estimated that 1 million California households ended up paying an additional $12 billion as a result. Since then, as California Attorney General Xavier Becerra has filed one lawsuit after another against Trump's administration, the state has sued it more than 60 times. The president has locked in a strategy of financially punitive responses and has weaponized the Environmental Protection Agency and other agencies in an effort to undermine signature California policies. In September, the administration announced it was ending a nearly 50-year-old waiver to the Clean Air Act that gave California, the country's largest single market for auto sales, the ability to set more stringent vehicle pollution and fuel efficiency standards than do the feds, an alternative environmental model around which other states could coalesce. The result will be far dirtier air in California and far fewer fuel-efficient cars on American roads. Absurdly, soon after trying to kill California's clean air standards, the EPA, which over the past 3 years has become a clearinghouse for big polluters, followed up by threatening to withhold billions of federal highway dollars from California because of its poor air quality. Adding insult to injury, Trump's EPA has been busy rolling back prohibitions on a range of particularly harmful pesticides, an end run around the efforts of California, New York, and other states to better regulate these deadly chemicals. Trump's war on California doesn't stop there. The president journeyed to the state in late September and spent much of his time bashing California for its homeless population. Yes, the problem has reached catastrophic proportions, but Trump used the crisis only to posture. He didn't go offering money to build houses or fund social services to tackle mental illness, drug addiction, or the lack of opportunities faced by ex-prisoners. Instead, he declared that Skid Rows in Los Angeles, San Francisco, and elsewhere were nuisances and urged extraordinarily coercive illegal responses, such as rounding up the homeless wholesale and forcibly detaining them in federal facilities. While he rants about California's homelessness crisis, Trump has been trying to neuter the Affordable Care Act and roll back SNAP, the food stamp program. If implemented, both of these attacks on the social safety net would disproportionately hit California, which has been particularly effective in recent years in using expansions in federal benefits to deliver services more effectively to its most vulnerable residents. If, at Trump's urging, the courts rule the ACA unconstitutional, California would lose billions of federal dollars overnight, and many of the state's most vulnerable residents would be pushed further into destitution. In a recent letter to California Governor Gavin Newsom, Trump's EPA administrator claimed that San Francisco's toleration of homelessness was contributing to water pollution, citing reports of streets filled with needles, human feces, and other toxic waste. While it's true that homeless encampments have been linked to unhealthy levels of E. coli in some rivers, it's also the case that California is among just a handful of states that have enacted legislation guaranteeing access to safe drinking water as a human right. Given this, there is more than a whiff of hypocrisy to the EPA's threat to sanction California. None of this is the ordinary back and forth that routinely occurs between the states and the federal government. This is mob-style politics, the politics of the strong arm and the iron fist, of blackmail and protection rackets. No matter where we live, we all have a dog in this fight. For if California is forced to bend to Trump's will, the country as a whole will pay the long-term costs. That was written by Sasha Abramsky, A-B-R-A-M-S-K-Y. Abramsky, whose Signal Noise column can be found at thenation.com twice weekly, is the author most recently of Jumping at Shadows, The Triumph of Fear and the End of the American Dream. We're going to continue in this double issue of the Nation magazine, and we're going to hear a piece written by Katha Pollitt, a regular contributor to The Nation. Her essay is titled, A Bittersweet Pill to Swallow. Will abortion pills transform reproductive choice in a post-Roe America? The news that the Supreme Court will hear its first abortion case since Brett Kavanaugh replaced Anthony Kennedy has prompted many to wonder whether Roe v. Wade will finally, unfortunately, be overturned. The case June Medical Services v. G challenges a Louisiana law requiring clinic doctors to have admitting privileges at a nearby hospital. Sound familiar? In 2016, in Whole Woman's Health v. Hellerstedt, the court struck down a Texas law over a similar requirement. You'd think it would have settled the matter, but no. The case is essentially the same, but the court is not. Abortion rights advocates have been warning about the end of Roe for decades. So far, they've been wrong, and they may be wrong this time, too. Overturning Roe so close to the elections would hurt Republicans. A June NPR PBS NewsHour Marist poll found that 77% of Americans support Roe v. Wade, even if they'd like more abortion restrictions. That means that from a practical anti-choice point of view, it makes more sense to preserve Roe on paper while permitting regulations that close clinics, harass providers, and put women through hell. Barring a federal ban, the court could keep Roe and still essentially enshrine in law the patchwork map of abortion rights that Roe was meant to end. In fact, we're well on our way there already. 6 states have only one clinic each: Kentucky, Mississippi, Missouri, North Dakota, South Dakota, and West Virginia. Since the Republican triumphs of 2010, nearly 400 restrictions have been passed in state legislatures. At the same time, a few blue states, including Maine, California, and New York, have increased abortion access. If the Kavanaugh Court upholds the restriction at issue, it will be open season on clinics, not to mention on women. More women will have to travel long distances to find a clinic, with prohibitive expenses for transportation, hotel accommodations, child care, and lost work. They will face more risks from abusive partners or family and more shaming from anti-choicers, because it's not that easy to keep a long trip secret. New York City and Austin, Texas, have allotted funds to help. Abortion funds, which pay for low-income women's procedures, are doing heroic work, as are funds like the Bridget Alliance and the Fund Texas Choice, which pay and arrange for travel. Readers should donate whatever they can to these wonderful volunteer groups, but there's only so much they can do even now, let alone in the tidal wave of need that is likely to come. Pro-choicers often warn of a return to the bad old pre-Roe days. In some ways, it may be worse. Anti-abortion propaganda has raised the status of the fetus much higher than it was pre-Roe. Before legalization, abortion was widely practiced and tacitly condoned. It's unclear whether even one woman was incarcerated in the United States for ending her pregnancy in the roughly 150 years abortion was a crime, and providers were rarely punished unless a woman died. Today, abortion is a political flashpoint defined as murder by a militant and highly effective organized anti-abortion movement. Anti-abortion leaders say they will never punish women for having an abortion, but we have already seen women charged with various crimes for miscarriages and stillbirths tenuously connected to their conduct during pregnancy, and sometimes convicted under arcane laws for self-abortion. In one important way, though, we won't be revisiting the past. The coat hanger, that dread symbol of the dangerous methods many women used pre-Roe, has largely been replaced by pills. Mifepristone and misoprostol, the same medications used in clinics to end an early pregnancy, or misoprostol alone, which is 75% to 85% effective. Abortion pills are 5 to 10 times safer than Viagra, and you can find them easily on the Internet, despite the FDA's attempts to prevent online pharmacies from selling them. They produce a miscarriage indistinguishable from a natural one. So in the unlikely event you need to go to an emergency room, your secret is safe. American women are already seeking out these pills. In the month after Trump's election, there were more than 200,000 U.S. Internet searches for self-managed abortion. The existence of these pills doesn't change America's retrograde attitude towards women's rights, of course, but it may provide some reprieve should the Supreme Court's right wing have its sway. In Ireland, where the near-total ban on abortion was repealed in a 2018 referendum, self-managed abortion helped change people's minds. Voters saw that abortion could not be stopped. When the Postal Service impounded suspicious packages, women had the pills mailed to different addresses or obtained obtained them by hand from underground networks. Goretti Horgan, a socialist feminist campaigner and professor at Ulster University, has been working for years to legalize abortion in Northern Ireland. The procedure is illegal there, except in cases of grave danger to the woman's life. The use of pills is very widespread here, she told me, and there is just no way to stop it. As in Ireland, pills have played an important role in building support for decriminalization, which seems imminent unless the two major parties can put together a last-minute power-sharing agreement. People saw that even when they face prosecution, desperate women will do anything to stop a pregnancy. Recent studies show that about 1,000 Northern Irish women traveled to England for legal clinic terminations last year, and about 700 ordered illegal pills at home in 2017. If enough women deprived of legal abortion turn to pills rather than keep unwanted pregnancies, will Americans, too, see that abortion is unstoppable and force politicians to legislate accordingly? You mustn't get too upset about the makeup of your court, Horgan said cheerfully, recalling how in 1992 massive demonstrations made the Supreme Court reverse a lower court ruling barring Miss X, a 14-year-old rape victim, from going to England for termination. In the end, Horgan says, the status of abortion will come down to people power. And maybe some pill power, too. That was Katha Pollitt's essay, taken from the October 28th and November 4th combined issue of The Nation magazine. We have just a couple minutes remaining, enough time for Calvin Trillin's poem. He is the deadline poet for The Nation. He writes, on Trump asking China to investigate the Biden. Jim Jordan has said that it's clear that this was a joke Trump contrived, which makes it, of course, quite all right. A new Billy Bush has arrived. Calvin Trillin, Deadline Poet, taken from the October 28th and November 4th double issue of The Nation magazine. This brings us now to the close of another edition of Alternative Press Review. Thank you for tuning in. Goodbye.